From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the hunt for Bigfoot with a group of people who actually want to kill Bigfoot. We'll talk about that. Here's what's happening. The West Africa could face up to 10,000 new Ebola cases a week within a couple months, according to the World Health Organization, adding that the death rate in the current outbreak has now risen to 70%. That's alarming. The death toll from the Ebola virus outbreak has now risen to 4,447 people, with the large majority of victims in West Africa, again, according to the World Health Organization. A UN medical worker infected with Ebola has died at a hospital in Germany now, and a union made troubling allegations about the Texas hospital, where a nurse contracted Ebola, claiming guidelines were constantly changing and that there were no protocols about how to deal with this deadly virus. Joe Gomez has worked for many nationally honored news stations in the past. KOA in Denver, KIRO in Seattle, KTRH in Houston, our affiliate there, and now he's a national correspondent for iHeartMedia. Joe, I've got to ask you, how is the nurse doing right now?
Well, they're saying that she's in stable condition. Now, it's important to note that she had actually found out she had the symptoms of the Ebola virus quite early on, and she admitted herself to the hospital voluntarily. And had she not been a healthcare worker, perhaps she would not be in as good a condition as she is now. And indeed, we saw this with Thomas Eric Duncan this past week. Mm-hmm. He was not admitted to the hospital immediately. He was sent home, and he had to go back in a couple of days. And the Ebola virus systematically shuts down your organs, one organ at a time. And once that happens, it's hard to regain the longevity of that organ.
Joe, this apparent panic that we're hearing all over the planet, is it founded or unfounded?
It's a question, George. I mean, you look at this nurse right now that has Ebola virus in Dallas. Her name is Nina Pham. She's 26 years old. She had just graduated from Texas Christian University. She was not on the short list of the 48 people to watch, according to the CDC. The CDC had 48 individuals that they determined had either primary or secondary contact with Mr. Thomas Duncan. And they were checking the temperatures regularly and monitoring every day. Nina Pham was not on that list. Now, what does that tell us?
You still with us?
It's very disconcerting.
Yeah, it sure is. Joe, thanks. You're going to hear a lot from Joe as he pops in. He's a national correspondent for iHeartMedia, and his website, joegomeznews.com. Mexico's attorney general says DNA tests have shown that 28 bodies found in a mass grave are not those of a missing group of students. The 43 students went missing 3 weeks ago amid violent protests in a town south of Mexico City. 14 more police officers there have been arrested, accused of handing the students over to drugs and gangs. About 50 people have been arrested in connection with the students' disappearance, with a mass majority being local police officers. ISIS, Islamic State fighters, surrounded one of Iraq's largest air bases. The militants are preparing now to launch an attack on another military air base halfway between the cities of Hit and Haditha. It seems to be out of control. They seem to be taking almost every town in Iraq or in portions of Syria. Let's check in with Howard Bloom. His new book, by the way, is called The Mohammed Code. Howard, nobody's stopping these people.
Nobody's stopping them because our airstrikes so far have not been effective, even though we have said several times that we're rolling them back. They're not being stopped in Kobane. In Kobane, there are 13,000 Kurds whose lives are at stake. Everybody knows the plan. They've seen it in the 60 villages around Kobane, all of which have been taken. You round up the men. You give them a chance to convert to Islam. If they don't convert, it's off with their heads. You take the women and children. You save them as sex. You sell them as sex slaves. That movement, that constant taking of new towns is happening in the Anbar province. ISIS has taken its third military base at Hit. It's on its way to Baghdad. In fact, it's surrounding Baghdad. And there's an old Muslim military ploy. It was invented by Muhammad. If you want to take a big city, you find a small, vulnerable town somewhere on its outskirts. You march into that town that cannot possibly resist you. You round up all the men. You cut their heads off. You do take the women and children as sex slaves. Your goal is to terrify the people in the big town so profoundly that any troops in that town will feel their knees shaking and will run as fast as they can, and the citizenry of that town will cave into you and surrender, which is exactly what happened when Muhammad wanted to take Mecca. He took the town of Mecca, his hometown, which was his biggest opponent. He took it without a single blow. Why? Because he performed genocide on a nearby town, and it scared everybody in Mecca to death. They were just happy to get away with their lives. This, the playbook that ISIS is using is straight out of Muhammad's original military strategy, and they've issued the fourth issue of their magazine, their English language magazine, their magazine designed to recruit your kids and my kids to be parts of ISIS. It is gorgeous. It is brilliantly art directed. On its cover, it proclaims in a giant cover line the revival of slavery. That's a great thing as far as they're concerned. And inside, where it talks, well, inside it says the following quote, "We will conquer your Rome, break your crosses, and enslave your women by the permission of Allah the Exalted. If we do not reach that time, then our children and grandchildren will reach it, and they will sell your sons as slaves at the slave market." Now, this doesn't just mean that they want to take the Vatican, though it does mean that, because the cover picture is the Vatican flying the flag of ISIS on top. Rome in the Hadith, in the holy books of Islam, Rome means all of Western Christendom. It means the entire European world. And in fact, they explain that further in this article, in this cover story. In other words, I have a friend. He's brilliant. He's a filmmaker. I'm in one of his films. And he says, look, if you just stopped giving us these alarmist reports of yours, you'd stop being a warmonger and this whole thing would go away. Let those people over there in the Middle East settle their own problems and we'll never hear from them again. He's wrong.
Of course he's wrong.
There is a global ambition here. It is a one world government ambition. One world government is a caliphate. And if we ignore it, we ignore it at our own.
Well, the problem, Howard, is it seems like we have ignored it. I mean, by one, I was always opposed to the Iraqi war in the first place. And there were no weapons of mass destruction there. We were lied to. Even President George Bush now admits that, you know what, he was wrong. He was given wrong information. The bottom line is, though, we went in there, we decimated a country, and we pulled out. And we left them with just nothing because the Iraqi army is incapable of protecting the citizens of Iraq. And look what's happening. I looked at a map today of all the pinpoints of where the ISIS militants have taken over. It's almost the entire country.
I've been recommending that we forget about this business of Bashar Assad being our enemy, that we ally with him. He has the only boots on the ground, the only forces that are willing to confront ISIS face to face, and that are willing to fight as ferociously as ISIS is willing to fight. He also has the only government capable of actually making sure that a territory is governed aside from ISIS itself. You know, ISIS is being welcomed because you no longer have to bribe the policemen, you no longer have to bribe the soldiers, and you don't have to worry about going down to the market and being blown up by a suicide attack if you live under ISIS control. Only Bashar Assad can offer that degree of governance in this part of the world. We cheered on as five dictators fell, and we thought what we were going to get is democracy. What we got is a chaos in which Islamism, in which jihadism has flourished. There's one of these dictators left. He and his tribe were providing a far higher level of education, a far higher level of medical service, freedom for women, and a relatively secular society in which all kinds of people could live relatively peacefully together. There's only one of those dictators left. We should have learned our lesson from the first five. It is time to keep this guy around.
Howard, good luck with the new book, The Muhammad Code. Always good talking to you and getting your insight into these events. New data shows that more young people are waiting to get married. According to the latest available census data, the percentage of U.S. adults who have never been married has now hit a new all-time high. In 1960, about 1 in 10 adults, 10% over the age of 25, fell into that category. By 2012, the number has now jumped to 1 in 5, 20%. There's no formal consensus about what's driving the numbers, but data shows that among young adults who say they do not want to get married, the economy is a major issue. Well, even if you've never been a fan of Glenn Campbell, this one's certain to tug at your heartstrings. The Country Music Hall of Fame member who has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease back a few years ago is out with a video for the final song he'll ever record. He says, "I'm not gonna miss you." It was recorded, by the way, in 2013. Campbell was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2005, best known for his hits like Rhinestone Cowboy, Wichita Lineman. Alzheimer's is taking him. St. Paul, Minnesota. Police have cited a 21-year-old man that they say entered a St. Paul home drunk and dressed as a Santa Claus zombie, terrifying a 16-year-old girl who locked herself in a bathroom and I guess was able to call police because they found him in the house asleep. And as we mentioned yesterday, the U.S. Air Force's mysterious unmanned plane, the X-37B, is about to come back to Earth after nearly 2 years in orbit on a mission the military just won't tell us much about. The X-37B is expected to land at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Now, the base did not give an exact time of the landing, though the FAA is kind of telling aviators and people in the area that the Southern California base and airspace around it will be closed from 8 to 5 p.m. Pacific time Wednesday. In a moment, we'll talk with space historian Robert Zimmerman about this incredible story about this two-year mission. I wonder what it was for. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Robert Zimmerman, of course, you've heard him before, award-winning space historian, and he writes articles and blogs about science, history, technology, and we're going to talk with him this hour about the Air Force's very mysterious unmanned space plane called the X-37B, built by Boeing. Robert, it's going to be here after 2 years. What the heck has it been doing?
Well, George, that's a good question. I can't pull out of my hat a clear answer, though I can give you some pretty educated guesses. Let's just review what the X-37B is.
Sure.
It is a fleet of two ships that the Air Force has had Boeing build. These two ships, this was originally actually a NASA program back in the 90s. NASA was going to build this reusable mini shuttle, unmanned robot shuttle that could go up into space and then come back again. And for reasons having to do with budget and stupid management at NASA, these are not surprises, they canceled the program. And the Air Force says, hey, well, wait a minute, this is maybe useful. In fact, it's totally useful. So they picked it up, and they funded Boeing to build two ships. And they built two ships, and the first ship, the thing is about a little less than 30 feet long.
Yeah, it's not very big.
No, it's like a pickup truck. Think of a pickup truck. Literally, think of a pickup truck. A little small in that. The cargo bay is a little small in the back of a pickup truck. Not very much room. You really couldn't use it as a human vehicle as built. The first ship was built and launched in 2010 and stayed in space for 8 months and came back. That was followed by the second ship, which went up in March 2011 and stayed in orbit for about 16 months. I don't know the exact number. And then it came back to Earth, as far as we know, in good shape. We saw video, actually, of it on the ground in the runway when they were decontaminating it and prepping it for unloading. And then the first ship that had already flown in space was sent up into space again 22 months ago, and it's been in orbit now for 22 months. Very quiet. It's almost like the Soviet era. There's a lot of amateurs who follow its orbit and periodically announce the orbit has changed slightly and it's repositioned itself. But that's all we basically know. And then earlier this week, Air Force says it's going to bring it back to Earth. Its planned return was supposed to be today. I've been checking. As far as I know, no news yet. As you noted in the early, that as I've read in some places too, that they have told that it could happen any time this evening between like 10, 5 a.m. Pacific. There's weather conditions, so it might not even happen tonight, but it's definitely going to keep coming back this week. Now, you asked me, George, what is this thing?
What are they doing with it? And are we sure it's unmanned?
Yes, we're absolutely sure it's unmanned.
Okay.
Like I say, it's not big enough. It doesn't have the capability. 22 months, the amount of supplies. You know, they got to resupply ISS on a regular basis, and that's a lot bigger and has a lot more capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no chance there's a human on it. The most obvious thing this thing is certainly being used for is to test equipment in the environment of space. And this is a valuable ability to have because, you know, let's say you build really sophisticated new reconnaissance or surveillance equipment, either to check into other people's electronics, listen in, or maybe you want to take pictures at very high resolution, or maybe you want to detect infrared heat from rockets being launched, and you've come up with new technology to do this at very high resolution. Well, you can build a satellite and launch it and see if it works, but you're working a little blind. You don't know how that equipment will work in space. So the number one theorized use that the Air Force is putting this to is to build, you know, create a new kind of equipment for either reconnaissance or surveillance, put it in the X-37B and launch it, and then when you bring it back to Earth, see how it fared in that harsh environment. And then you can make engineering refinements, fix it up a little bit better, make it even more sophisticated possibly, and then send it up again and see how it fares in the harsh environment space. That's the number one theory for what they're using.
Why can't you send that kind of equipment to the International Space Station?
Well, there's security issues there. You go to the ISS, everyone's going to see it, including the Russians who have astronauts on ISS all the time.
So is this a weapon?
Well, it's not so much a weapon, but it's surveillance equipment, and you don't want to, from a security perspective, I can understand the Air Force not wanting anyone else to know exactly what their capabilities are when it comes to surveillance and reconnaissance. When, you know, you don't want a Russian astronaut who's very sophisticated in these matters or their engineers to be able to look at such equipment. And plus, the International Space Station is not really the best environment for testing this kind of thing because it's, for one thing, it might not be in the right orbit, and for another, it's a dirty environment. And I don't mean it, that's not as a negative thing, but for a perspective of doing research, you got a lot of other gases and waste products that are released from the station itself, and thruster firings, and so it's not a very good place to put such a thing. In fact, the Russians themselves are building a module that's going to fly parallel to ISS and periodically dock with it, and they want to be able to fly parallel at a distance to get it away from ISS to do its own research, and that's scientific research. So, no, it doesn't make sense to send it to ISS. This is gives them great flexibility here. They can send the X-37B, either one of the two ships, up to appropriate orbit for testing the specific thing, equipment they want to test, and then move it when they need to a different orbit, which is what they've done with the X-37B that's been up and off for 2 years. Now, will it come? You know, it's got to come back safely. It's done this once before, but this will be the first return visit of this particular ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see what happens when it comes back. We haven't heard any word yet.
And 22 months is a long time.
Well, it's almost 2 years, yes. So there's other testing going on here. It's not just what's in the cargo bay. It's the ship itself. They're testing to see if it's functional it will function properly after 2 years in the harsh environment of space.
Sure. I bet they'll look at it, Robert, to see if there are little dents and dings and all these things.
Yeah, exactly. And see how the radiation of space has damaged its equipment over time. I mean, this happens naturally with ISS, too. And you can bring it back to Earth and actually look at it. Think about this a minute. They are getting the advantage that actually no one has ever had before. They're going to be looking at a vessel that's been in space for 2 years and seeing how it fared. And there's no other vehicle. The Soyuz lifeboats only stay up to 6 months. So this is a very unique engineering opportunity for the Air Force, without question.
I'll come back with you, Robert, in just a moment. We're going to talk more about this. We'll take some phone calls as well. What else is going on in space? Robert Zimmerman's with us this hour on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're about ready to hit a new milestone on Facebook. So if you haven't liked us yet, simply go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, and click the Facebook icon in the upper right-hand corner. I need 50 of you right now to do that. And welcome back to Coast, Bob Zimmerman with us, the space historian. His website, of course, behindtheblack.com. We'll get to your calls as well for the rest of this half hour. This is exciting, though. Just the fact that we've got something like this, Boeing put it together. Did they? I assume they bid for it, didn't they, Rob?
Yeah, originally this was a contractual situation. The concept was something actually that this is under the old system. It was a concept that NASA came up with, and they wanted someone to build it for them. Things are changing now. What's instead happened is NASA says it has a need and lets other people design things for them, and they're getting some production for that. I'd like to mention this. This is very interesting. There's going to be a series of spacewalks for the next few months, over the next year on ISS. And what they're going to be doing is they're going to be reconfiguring the station to open up four different docking ports on the station. And that's so they could have two different cargo vehicles docked there, as well as two manned vehicles docked there. And if things go as I expect them to, those four craft will be built by four different American companies and will be all radically different from each other, either capsules or spacecraft of some kind. So think about that a minute. And they're going to also, in the process of reconfiguring ISS next year, they're going to add a module built by a private company. So think about that.
You're going to have an
ISS, four different spacecraft built by American companies, different companies, plus a module built by an American company, all for very little money. That's kind of the kind of thing that when I was a kid in the 60s, that was what I was expecting to start to happen. Lots of American companies coming up with really cool ideas, and you mix and match together to get a lot accomplished. It's kind of really cool. And Boeing's building one of those craft, and it's not an X-37B, it's a capsule. So there's just interesting combinations going on.
How far ahead is Boeing, Robert, from the other companies? Or are they all pretty competitive in terms of knowledge, technology?
Well, Boeing has the experience as a company. You know, a lot of very good engineers work there. They have the problem of being one of those big lumbering giants that has lived off the government till for decades and therefore is not very aggressive or competitive, very corporate in their attitude. In terms of the company that's in the lead for creating a manned vessel, there's no question. It's SpaceX. They've got the capsule that's already flown several times successfully. All they need to do is create a launch abort system for during the launch period so people can be brought back safely to Earth. And they're in the process of doing that right now. And in December and January, they're going to do launch abort tests where they'll actually have a Dragon on a Falcon 9 and they'll actually fire it off the rocket on the launch pad in the first test to see if it can come back to Earth safely should there be a problem on the launch pad. And then they'll do another test flight where they'll actually fire the Falcon 9, get it up, you know, during launch in the first, like, few minutes, and then the launch abort system will separate the capsule and bring it down to Earth safely. And then once they've done those two tests, they will have shown they have a system that will work, and that capsule could put people on it at that point.
What's new behind the black?
Well, I mean, I've been writing about a lot of stuff that's going on in space right now that's really cool. The coolest thing going on right now has to do with comets, and I have a picture on Behind the Black from Comet 67P/CG that Rosetta is right now orbiting from a distance of only 6 miles. And Rosetta took this incredible series of pictures, George, and I've got one posted on the webpage, of a relatively smooth area on the comet's larger lobe. This comet has two big lobes that are kind of connected by a narrow neck. It kind of looks like a duck. And on the larger lobe, there's kind of like a smooth area, and on it were these giant boulders. Now, this picture on the web on my website is very cool because the scale, the biggest boulder on the kind of middlemost boulder is about 150 feet across by a height of about 80 feet. And if you look at the picture, and think about it a minute, you can realize that if a person was walking on that smooth area, you would really be able to just see that dot. So this gives you a sense of scale of the image. Now, what are those boulders? It's actually premature to say they're boulders because this is a comet. And what do comets do? They vent material when they get heated up.
Well, what could it be if it's not a boulder?
Well, I'm thinking it could be a harder material that is being exposed. It's not a separate boulder on the surface, but it's actually bedrock that is now being exposed as the soft, smooth material around it vents off. That soft, smooth material could very well be a pond. Now, not a pond of liquid. We found this on other asteroids where the gravitational field is so weak that sand kind of flows down
into
the low areas to form ponds. Now, this, in this case of a comet, it's not pure sand. It's a mixture of water, ice, not water, ice, and other dirty dirt. And so what you have here is this smooth area could be an air, could be, I'm guessing, I'm speculating, we really don't know, the scientists are very clear on this website, they still don't know, but what you could have here is a situation where as that material vents off when the comet gets heated as it goes near the sun, the bedrock areas that don't vent away get revealed, and that's what these little boulders are. Now, I could also be completely wrong. This is speculation. We don't know enough yet. It's going to take more looking by Rosetta. These could be boulders sitting on the surface. And my first impression when I looked at them is that they seem to lie there very lightly, which is also true if the gravitational field is very weak.
It should be weak.
Them off, you know, it's not going to take much to get them off the surface there. That whole mission has got me really excited, George. I post pictures from them pretty regularly because in mid-November they've got a lander that's going to implant itself on the nucleus of comets.
Just great technology.
It's incredible, and it's going to be able to take pictures of the surface when it hits, if everything goes right. It doesn't have any engines, by the way. Fly is the name of the lander, and it flies. They're going to release it. And it's going to literally, like a spike, implant itself in the surface. It's just going to come down very slowly, and it's got a spike, and it's going to sort of like go jam into the surface, and that's how it's going to land. So that'll be interesting in itself. Hopefully it'll work. This Rosetta itself is going to stick with this comet for the next year as it moves to its close approach to the sun when the comet gets more active. And so we'll see venting going on in close-up of a comet nucleus. It's going to be really cool to watch this over the next year, day by day. It's really going to be cool.
All right, let's go take some calls. We're with Robert Zimmerman talking about the mysterious Air Force space plane that will probably land maybe while I'm on the air, most likely tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning. Let's go to Mark in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to get things going here. Mark, go ahead.
How you doing there?
Good.
Hey, Mark.
How are you, Mr. Zim? It seems like so they're going to light crash that thing into the comet, huh?
No. Well, the lander, Fly, it's a passive landing system. What they're going to do is they'll release it at the right velocity. They're close enough now. They're only 6 miles above the surface now, but they'll release it at the right velocity, aimed at the right spot where they want it to land, and they'll have it oriented in the right way. And yes, it's going to just implant itself on the surface. Remember, we're talking about very weak gravities here, so as it falls in, it's not going to be going at a relatively fast speed. This is very sophisticated engineering, but it is not, you know, high-level physics. It just requires thoughtfulness and good engineering. And I think based on everything that the European engineers have done with Rosetta up to now, they've hit it on the mark every time, and so I'm very confident this will work.
Well, they've got to find a light spot or a soft spot, right?
Yes, that's a good question. They've looked – they actually, when they first got close to the comet, they started to take lots of pictures, and they picked four potential sites, candidate sites. They spent about a week doing more observations, and then they picked their number one site. And they picked the site on the outside of a lobe that's relatively smooth. And it's in some ways it's not as interesting as other sites, but obviously it's a safer place to land. One of the candidate sites was on the inside of the lobe, you know, so you could look down at the neck. But the trouble is, then you got to get inside, and there's more risks involved with that. So they picked a relatively smart area to land in. They're going to spend, obviously, the next few weeks taking lots of close-up pictures of the landing site, and they'll refine their landing to try to bring it in very precisely. And I think they'll be in a position where they can get it in pretty precise. I don't know the exact range they have here, but I have a feeling they can be pretty good.
Just exciting. All these space things are exciting.
It's science fiction come to life.
Joe. Kodiak, Alaska, it's Bill's turn. Hey, Bill, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you, George. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question for your guest. Is there any correlation between the returning X-craft and the possibility of the hypersonic glide weapons that they've been testing for the past couple of years? One, actually, they just tried to test about a month ago, launching from Kodiak Island here, and the launch failed. Is there any correlation as to whether they could be trying to track it or anything like that?
No, you know, that's an interesting question. Now, the X-37B has been up for 22 months, and we don't know what's in its payload. It's theorized it's some form of, you know, a military reconnaissance or surveillance. But I don't know what specifically it's used for. There's no doubt that if it was some form of good photography equipment, they might have been able to photograph those missions. I would not think the X-37B, though, would be the ideal instrument for doing that. They, you know, someone who's better with orbital mechanics and engineering than I might want to take a look at the orbital position of X-37B during those hypersonic test flights, because and the timing of those flights, because it could be that, yes, they were lined up so they could take advantage of the X-37B to do observations. But in that case, it would be just simply the observations of the experimental flight, improve their understanding of what the flight actually accomplished. The X-37B, it has a certain James Bond flair to it, you know, George. You could hit the cargo bay and, you know, maybe they could send it up and capture another satellite, but it isn't big enough to really do any of that. It could capture some CubeSats, but there's no military spacecraft that are CubeSats right now.
We go next to Nick in Michigan. Welcome to the program, Nick. Go ahead.
Thank you, George.
Thanks.
Since STS-48, if either of you recall that, I remember it distinctly, because the astronauts were filming live. In fact, that was the last live video feed of the shuttle mission. And, of course, it chronicled a UFO reversing its position, and then maybe a second later, what could only be described as a laser shot, precisely where it had just reversed from. So I wanted Bob's take on that. Also, in the moonshot missions, George, I still am a doubting Thomas about landing on the moon. And I recall Professor Van Allen, history recording, that he came out rather adamantly stating that there's no way the present technology of that era could possibly protect the astronauts from the radiation belt going through it, coming back.
That's a false quote. I'm sorry. I have to tell you that's not true. Van Allen, as a scientist, always opposed the man program. There's no doubt about that.
Why?
He opposed it because he wanted the money spent on unmanned research, science, and he always felt the man program was stealing from that. I didn't agree with him on that, but that's a valid position. But he understood very clearly the technologies involved. He also understood that the radiation belt was not going to kill people going through the Van Allen belts. He knew that, and he would never have said that. That's just that's not true. That's not a correct quote.
Is that one of those Snopes myths?
Yeah, I mean, these quotes get thrown out. People, sometimes they're made up.
Because I had heard that a long time ago.
Make up quotes, and they get quoted and quoted back again. In fact, there's a great story about how someone just simply made up a quote that supposedly Neil deGrasse Tyson said. It was the kind of thing he might have said, and then passed it off on Reddit, and people started to quote it back, and never said it was made up. And so that's not a true quote. There's a lot about, once again, Van Allen, that there's a certain undercurrent of truth in that he opposed the man program, but he definitely understood the technology was capable of doing it. And yes, we went to the moon. I'm sorry, you might be a skeptic, but you're being a skeptic over the wrong kinds of things. I mean, there are too many people involved, and there are people who died to make it happen. And I've talked to too many of them over the years. And I always applaud Buzz Aldrin for punching the guy in the face who made the accusation to him, because it's
Bart Sobrell. Bang.
It's just offensive because people died to make that happen.
No, I agree with you. We went to the moon.
It's one of the great achievements of our country. Why should we be ashamed of it? We should be proud of it.
Do you think some of the pictures that we've seen where they do analyze it, they say, how can this be? You think they were some of the pictures that they took in the studio for illustration purposes and they got mixed in?
No, absolutely not. Oh, no. And most of the time, these analysis of these images is just really poor analysis, I must tell you. The moon's surface, it's not like the Earth. I mean, you have no sunlight. I mean, you have no atmosphere. The shadows are harsh, but you're going to get still reflected light within the dark area, so it's not going to be pitch black. And so they purposely picked landing sites, to create a great deal of shadows. It was not at noon. It was towards the sun was closer to the horizon to create shadows to make it easier for them to see the surface when Neil Armstrong and others astronauts were bringing the LEM down to land. And so you get those kind of shadow effects. That's just the way it is. And every analysis I've seen about supposedly these shadows are not real, it's just foolish. I'm sorry. They're trying hard to disprove a reality instead of just look at what we did and be proud of it. It's just a great thing. Well, no other country in the world doubts it. They're all wish to get back there.
Of course.
And pick up souvenirs, you know.
Nobody has said that. It's true. Tom in Tampa, let's wrap it up with you, Tom. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening. I was just wondering, I wanted to ask Mark, the Challenger accident that happened in 1986, they were going to study Halley's Comet from the shuttle. Is this test they're going to do any kind of correlation to that in terms of, okay, they missed their chance with Halley's Comet. Are they doing that now with this and hoping to get the same kind of
knowledge, result?
Exactly.
Halley's Comet was an opportunity. It only comes every 76 years. And so there was a bunch of probes that went out there to try to get good looks at it. It was much earlier in our space technology, so those probes couldn't quite do this kind of stuff we can do today. What Rosetta is trying to do is just get more knowledge. It'll be the first comet that we really are going to get a long-term look at close up. I mean, Halley's were just flybys, and Halley's was a once-in-a-life opportunity. This is a much longer-term research, and this is just get us more knowledge, and we'll just pile on, get more knowledge down the road. And you know what? This will be the first. That doesn't mean Rosetta will be the last cometary mission. I think there will be many more, and when Halley's Comet returns, in what is it now, about 35 years, I'm doing that math quick in my head, ready to go back.
I'm not sure you and I will be ready, though.
Well, I hope to be here.
35 years from now? Let's see, how old are you now?
I'm 61.
You might be here.
My goal is to be here, absolutely. You too, George.
I'd be right up there with you, that's for sure.
Yeah.
We'd be old.
Well, by that
very,
time,
very old.
Be able to go on a Bigelow space station on a Falcon Heavy with a Dream Chaser spacecraft to get a very nice, gentle flight up into weightlessness where you can live an extra 20 years of life.
I'd be bored. Bored out of my mind up there, Bob.
Hmm?
I'd be bored out of my mind up there for 20 more years.
You can do your radio show from there. There's no reason to do it from the ground.
And then what do I do?
You could call me. You know, I could do a live in studio thing with you. I'm a Bigelow station.
I would do it for a week.
Oh. Hopefully in 35 years, they won't just be going around the Earth, remember. I would expect us to be traveling to the moon on a regular basis and going elsewhere. Once we get all these companies going, and there's competition, and there's profit to be made, the sky is the limit, and a lot can happen very, very, very quickly. Just think how different things were between 1900 and 1950.
Robert Zimmerman's website, BehindTheBlack.com. Up next, we're going to talk with two very serious Bigfoot investigators who want to prove that Bigfoot does exist by bringing back a dead one.